Welcome to this episode of The Optimism Show. Today as our special guest, we have Tim Dow, the co-founder of Kiwi News, a decentralized media platform. With Tim today, we're discussing a few topics, including what it takes to really bootstrap a business and the impacts venture capital funds have on media integrity in terms of how fundraising can impact the actual path media companies take throughout their growth. Let's get started.
How's everything going though? How's the week so far?
Yeah, good, good. We are a bit adjusting, I would say. In my view, the market outlook is not super great at the moment. Seems to be rather bearish. And I also wrote a post about how I think that a lot of risk assets are actually being sold off. Like you could, if you look into the CoinGecko and so on, and you find kind of projects that have like pretty good teams, I would say, like Gitcoin or whatever, you can see that their market cap has gone down quite a lot, while like the more blue chip companies like or projects like Ethereum have kept up. And so I think that this is kind of like a flight to safety. You know, people are going through their portfolio and they're like, what is the most risky thing and what do I have least conviction in? And so they're just like, to cover expenses, probably they're just like selling these. And I feel like it's like a tough spot, obviously, for anyone that wants to build like a high risk thing. So we have to really understand basically what we are supposed to do in this market condition. And essentially what we're saying and what's really also, I think, what I also believe in as an investor is like, okay, then you just need to serve the fundamental value, right? So for Kiwi News, like, are people getting news? Does the website work? Then for us as producers of the website, are we getting paid? It's just like, I don't know, it's like very simple, like make it a good business, you know, don't speculate too much, just make it usable and trust that this fundamental value is creating the value that you can use to sustain the business. Because at the end of the day, I think what it also will show, if this continues to be so bearish, is that a lot less risk taking is going to happen, a lot less liquidity is going in the market for these risk assets. I also feel like we will have much less competition actually within, like if this just continues for another 6 months, I don't think we will have much competition, because nobody will take, like no external person will take the risk of like funding something like Kiwi News. The fact that I'm funding it today is because I know our fundamentals very well, right? But somebody that doesn't have a good insight into it might not know them. So I also don't expect them to invest in us at this point in time.
Yeah, but it's exactly the potentially the best period of time to actually build something that's strong foundationally. So then you can actually make something big.
Maybe. I mean, if you think about the fact that the liquidity is just constrained, like less investments are happening, then I would say yes, because basically you have less of a competitive environment. You probably need to shout less online about what you are doing, right?
Yeah.
Because, for example, if you remember the 2021 bull market, everyone was shouting at the top of their lungs, right? Like, it was crazy. And that was just because everybody else was shouting. So there wasn't actually really any point to shouting. You wouldn't get more from it. You were just retaining your level of marketing. And at this stage, for example, I think that's actually like just one facet of it, right? The other facet is kind of the taking duration risk as a bootstrap company is also very interesting, because usually like I'm by no means an expert on venture capital or even the industry in general or whatever, but what I've seen personally is that investors usually have some kind of time horizon that they give each other and projects in the industry to succeed. Like, for example, music NFTs, I think, are a pretty good example, where they were kind of in fashion for a while, I think towards the end of the bull market. And they were five, let's say like five portfolio companies from investors that looked really promising. And I feel like investors, they have this point of view that they're like, okay, we're trying this. We'll evaluate the numbers on this. And if it keeps on growing, like if the numbers are looking good for us, we'll put more money in, and vice versa as well, right? If the numbers don't work out, we'll not put more money in. What's interesting about it is that from the point of view of a bootstrapper, let's say, is that first of all, a lot of infrastructure is being generated. This thing is a trend that gets established at that point. Some technology is being written for these music NFTs. And so if investors are coming to the conclusion that this is not a venture scale business, that doesn't mean that there isn't business value in that sector anymore for people who might want to have different outcomes. So if I'm willing to take an investment with an outcome that is smaller than a $1 billion company, there might still be good business opportunities in that sector, in my view. So, so you can actually beat venture capital investors in certain areas by taking on a longer duration. Like, I will be bullish longer on music NFTs than you because, you know, maybe I have special insights, or I don't need to have the outcome size of a venture scale investor and so on.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, it's the long term. And it's interesting that you mentioned this, because after we record and everything, I'd like to share some ideas with you that we've been brainstorming that is directly aligned with this and what we've touched on a bit last time, how the media companies can actually, like the Web3 media companies and everything, can sustain over the long term without having to take venture capital funds. But I'm gonna share that later. I don't want to touch on that topic right now. I'm pretty sure we'll dive so much deep into it that we'll forget about everything else. So let's finish this. And I'd love to hear your feedback on that. It's something that we already started working on like a few days ago as well.
Media companies not taking venture, you mean?
No, how to really sustain the media operations and actually monetize the power of media without having to take venture funds and without having to change what you're posting and the media integrity.
Yeah, I think this is another interesting one, right? Because I think you can see it everywhere, kind of how the ownership of media companies influences their integrity, right?
Like, it influences it so much. I was just doing specifically, I never even intended to get into this sector, but just the flow got me into a sector of media. Mm-hmm. The thing there was what was it? 8 months, 9 months ago, I did an academic paper on how VCs impact the integrity of the media. Mm-hmm. And after that, got into it. I don't even know why I did that paper, but I guess this is why. So it's like, okay, this is the thing that needs to be fixed first if we're going to fix a lot more things, because it's literally manipulation at this point rather than actual journalism that makes a difference. It's more like who gets the most views, gets the most paychecks. And after that, it's like, okay, we cannot get that many views. Let's get some VC funds. And then the VC funds are, you have to post this and follow this agenda. Mm-hmm. It's not that much, just 1% change. And then it's just 1% change. And it gradually messes up with the entire media integrity and the editorial integrity. Yeah, that's how I see it personally. And it usually happens like that.
We have a similar point of view in terms of online journalism, where the traditional model is that the newspapers, websites, they have these ads on the articles themselves. And so if you get paid per click on the ad or per view, impression, whatever. So the incentive for journalists, for everybody, for editors, whatever, is basically to get people on the site, right? So I don't know if it applies to New York Times, but anyways, like other newspapers that primarily focus on ad revenue. And so this is how you get these very ugly clickbaity titles and I guess even like false information or very speculative articles, because basically it just clicks really well if you say something outrageous that the reader is drawn to. And if you think about it, that really happens also because you have these social media networks and then like Twitter or whatever, and you know, you cannot advertise on them directly. So you have to kind of like bait people from that page into your news website to show the ad. And that's kind of similar to what you say, I would say.
To a certain extent, I just like to make this and then we can move to the other topics. But to a certain extent, I would say it is. Back in like even a year or two ago, that was my view. But on the other hand, I would also right now say that using those platforms and using those methods, so for example, manipulation and clickbait and everything, to get someone to actually read something that's true and it's valuable and it's written in a nice way, it's still, and you go with like a good intention to actually educate them, it's still worth it because those people anyways click on those titles. So if someone else can use to mislead someone, use the clickbait and use everything to mislead someone, why can't we use that to actually get someone to the right path?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I understand.
It's more like the ends justify the means, but in the end, like if that's the way to do it in certain areas, and that is certainly the way to do it, for example, on Twitter, if you want to grow on Twitter, you have to do that. Mm-hmm. That's the most effective way. But that doesn't mean that you have to be just like everyone else. You can still use that as a hook to get someone to where they should be.
Yeah, that is true.
That's the way I see it, actually.
That is true. I think also if you look at, I think even Veritasium on YouTube, if you know him,
yeah,
he's like a science channel. He has used this method quite a lot. And I mean, all of his videos are super educational. And he is really optimizing also for clickbaity title and so on. I agree with you, actually. I think if you just break it down as like, you know, as this is the most rational thing to do, ergo everybody has to do it, I think this is also not a correct model. I think there are many people who are very intentionally dissenting from that business model with a lot of success because it is known that this is a bad thing. And so you know, and most people are, I think, most like good enough critical thinkers to have started to understand this, or they've read it somewhere, this phenomenon, so that it has become a bit better. I guess it always goes back to like, do we as a society kind of have antibodies to respond to some of these new social phenomenons that are existing or happening? And I feel like sometimes we're like overwhelmed. But then I think over time we start to understand when, you know, how to react on a certain thing, like the media, it's basically media competence, essentially.
Yeah, no, exactly. It's like it's an evolution phase right now. And it's not only the only way, like, don't get me wrong, it's not the only way that I see there. But in certain parts where you would like to go, for example, Twitter or X or whatever it's going to be called next, that might be the way. On another platform, it's a completely different way. So for example, on Farcaster, I'm pretty sure that will never work, especially like considering how the community is and how everything works. Like those type of pushes won't necessarily work.
What type of pushes specifically?
Like the clickbaity, like super clickbaity, and like this type and that type, and like not necessarily true and straight to the point. Mm-hmm. I don't see it working necessarily. But on Twitter, that's the way to go.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I would say like there's really a different vibe for Farcaster and for Twitter. Like Farcaster is like really like a town or a village. And so most people know each other. Like, yeah. And so
it is.
And you know, like, you wouldn't, I grew up in a village, so if you do some, like, I don't know, you get drunk in the evening and you scream around or whatever, everybody in the village will know at the end of the day. Or you do something and somebody sees it and then everybody talks about you. The everybody knows everybody else's name, or they're like, oh, this is like the daughter or the son of this person or whatever. Whereas I think if you do in a city, you are very anonymous based just on the fact that there are just many people mixing with each other. So it's like much harder for a kind of reputation system to evolve that identifies everybody. And so I think this applies very well to Twitter and Farcast. So like if you like to be very, you know, like very direct, it's not a good strategy to do on Farcast because it generates a lot of drama, because people are not very forgiving with these types of interactions. Whereas on Twitter, that's the modus operandi. Like that's what you actually, I think like even Dan Romero once said, like the blood, he always calls it like the blood sport on Twitter. Like that's what people, like people just want that. Like they want to see the I guess gladiators in the arena discussing out certain topics or whatever. And on Farcast, it's more like, I think the vibe has been more to kind of build Web3 together as a community. And also I think for example, there was the, what's it called? Farcon meetup in LA. And that was very explicitly titled the URL to IRL pipeline. So a social network where you meet people online, but you actually become friends in real life, which I guess it also exists for Twitter, but it's not really the reason why people go to Twitter, right?
Oh, exactly. That's the main difference. And then you also have the censorship. And I'd love to hear like what we also set out to talk about. Like if you can touch a bit more on the topic, like for example, when it comes to censorship and you have the different social media websites that can absolutely block you. And then you have Farc. And you also, right now, as you're building Kiwi News, I would love to hear more about what you think about the censorship aspect and also the curation within Kiwi News, and also how you will keep running Kiwi News. And Kiwi News will keep running regardless of what happens. Like regardless if, really, I'll let you take it from there.
Yeah, I honestly think looking at it from purely to perspective of censorship is maybe that's difficult, right? Like I wouldn't actually say that Twitter in its current form is censoring in terms of like actually, I don't know, deleting opinions or whatever, but they are censoring in, I guess you can also say, you know, the reach that you get or that you can get on Twitter or X or Facebook or wherever, that is also a form of censorship, right? If I post something and it doesn't get any reach, then, and it doesn't get deleted, you can't really say, oh, that's not censorship. Like if certain viewpoints are suppressed, for example, then this might as well be censorship if it happens with an intention and it happens with like some editorial quality, let's say through the algorithm, you know, like somebody adjusts the algorithm a certain way. And so if you think about it from that perspective, then censorship really has two dimensions. It's like the content that is on the platform, can you see that it is still on the platform? Like, is it deleted or not? And then the other aspect of it is how is the algorithm actually treating the content? Like, does it get reach? Is it is the algorithm biasing towards certain topics and so on? And honestly, I mean, it's kind of crazy, but I feel like there are not really any platforms that are very transparent here. For example, the Twitter, like Elon Musk also open sources the Twitter algorithm from what I know. And I think only recently has published it on GitHub. But if you think about the algorithm, it's really like this machine. And at the top of the machine, you have all of these inputs. You have variables that you put, the configuration. I'm pretty sure you even have, you know, there are even like weights that are not really describable as what they do in the machine itself. So you can see really the machine as this kind of black box. And so I think, you know, if you just publish the machine that gives you the ranking of who should see what, that is kind of not enough proof to say, you know, we are a transparent company and, you know, you can trust us with giving you only a neutral point of view. And at the same time, now the opposite case is kind of Farcast or Warpcast, where they are not publishing their ranking machine. So Warpcast is closed source, but Farcast is this open source protocol. And so you can get all of the tweet data, likes, retweets, and so on. Or I guess in their case, you call them recasts. You don't really know how they're doing the ranking on the algorithm, right? So this is what we are doing fundamentally different with Kiwi News. We are giving you both the algorithm, the machine that ranks, and the data, and you can run the entire website with just one command on your command line, and you can essentially replicate the feed as it is shown on our website. And so you can't have any doubt actually about, you know, whether we are manipulating the feed or not, because you can literally just replicate it. Now there's actually, and then I think if you're beyond that, and if you say, you know, there is these feeds, they work with likes and retweets and comments, they create the ranking through that, and maybe they do like some machine learning analysis on trendy topics and so on. Mm-hmm. I think this is one way of looking at it, but there is also a lot of metadata used for ranking in these feeds, because, you know, when somebody likes something or retweets something, this is kind of like an intentional statement that I'm making, where me as a user, I am self-aware that this will somehow be attributed to me. So like back in the days, or just a few months ago, Twitter likes were public, right? So I think most people on Twitter kind of were like, maybe I shouldn't like this post, because actually it will show up under my, you know, like if it's, let's say, like a very spicy post that maybe you still agree with, but you don't want it to associate with your clear name identity, you wouldn't like it, right? Whereas, you know, you can share it to a friend, you can click on it, you can read it in full or watch it if it's a full video and so on. And so there is still a type of ranking data that is being recorded from all of these sites that at the moment, for example, is not published on a transparent network like Farcast and Kiwi News, right? Because also we couldn't even publish this kind of data, because it's probably like there are probably privacy concerns around it and so on. And so for example, for Kiwi News, what we do is we also track how many people actually clicked on the link. And this data is not published on the network. And it's just my impression that, you know, when we talk about Farcast and Kiwi News as these decentralized social networks, actually there is a component of this that we are really kind of not talking about at all, that is very, you know, fundamental to the actual performance of the algorithms themselves. Because actually the kind of data that you get from just monitoring user behavior, this is very powerful, right? Because it is revealed preference. It is preference that you can see in the data about the users are doing. Whereas the, you know, liking in public and showing your support with your associating yourself with a certain thing, this is more like a stated preference kind of action.
How do you really see it? Because right now it's still like Web3 media is just starting to really develop, and you're building Kiwi News. Like, how do you see Web3 media evolving over the next few years, let's say?
I think what is crucial is to understand kind of where Web3 is coming from, and that it is fundamentally, like, the entire crypto movement is fundamentally about freedom of money and freedom of finance. And so I don't think that can be divorced from the outcomes. What do I mean by that? If you would build a media company in the traditional space, in the traditional Web2 space, that you would always end up being... You would always end up having to forge relationships. You have Stripe, I don't know, you have like the link aggregators, maybe you have like sponsors, you have, you know, ad publishers and so on. And we have seen, I think, in the past that some of these institutions, they can act synchronously and they can just like deplatform you if they want to. Like, I don't know, very, very popular example is WikiLeaks that got like booted off of every possible credit card or payment processing platform, right? And I think if you, I think Web3 companies are fundamentally different from Web2 companies because the flow of money towards them and the processing of money, it can really not fundamentally be disrupted. Like, yes, it can, like you could outlaw it, you could, you know, you could make it harder or whatever, but fundamentally, these companies can always receive money. And there's also not one single actor that can say, no, this media company, we don't like what this media company is doing. Therefore, we are cutting off the funds, right? So I think this is, and like, this is to be considered because I think we've just seen in the past so often how kind of the payment processing or the ad network, like the ad sponsors and so on, are being used as leverage to create influence over, you know, what the media company should publish and so on. And so, I mean, this is also how we're building Kiwi News. And this is why when you go to our landing page, the first thing I think we say is that Kiwi News is self-funded. Yeah. Because I just think it really waters down the value proposition of a social media company to, let's say, take on investment of a famous crypto venture capital investor when you are, I mean, immediately from that point on, you are making yourself dependent on the funding of that entity unless you have an insanely good plan to get, you know, profitable and also fit their, you know, their venture capital outcome size and whatever, right? So, for example, you know, there are companies that are funded by, I don't know, A16Z, and then you have at the same, and for good reasons, you know, you have like A16Z being against the Democratic Party because they have this like $100 million, unrealized gains tax or whatever, right? But I feel like what people are kind of missing is that, okay, it's cool, you have gotten funding for your venture capital bet, you know, from a company like A16Z, but what are you going to do about Mark Andreessen and Ben Horowitz being very publicly outspoken against the Democrats, for example? Like, to me, this is a I don't even know if you have a choice as a portfolio company, right? To a certain degree, you obviously have a choice. Like, you can probably say what you want. But it's like a pipeline. Like you've entered the pipeline and so I would expect that there is some kind of loyalty or like, I don't know, like social pressure being applied or whatever. And, or maybe I don't even have to, you know, push that point very hard, but I can just say that if you are serving fundamentally your users, and this is what we are trying to do with Kiwi News, we are selling each user an NFT. It's not cheap. It's like $20. Then we are selling every individual. So only the group fundamentally would be able to tell us what to do. But we would always serve our users, right? And our users' interest. And that also aligns us in a way where our incentives are just to be as good as our users want us to be, right? Whereas I think when you serve ads, or when you have venture capital investors that have political opinions or whatever, then it's much more likely you're pursuing something that is in their interest, because this is where you get your money from. You get it from ads, or you get it from venture capital investors, and we get it from our users.
Yeah, this is the main difference. Like, even if you look at it from a media company perspective, like personally, how I see like to really create a strong media company is like, yes, you have to have one key figure, especially in the beginning, But what holds a media company is the community, is the readers, is the users, is the listeners, because that's who you're serving. So instead of looking at them, many VC-funded media companies, and I might be extremely wrong at this, but many companies see them just as machines to, like, practically NPCs to advertise to and milk for cash. You actually build it with the people and you serve the people in the end.
Yeah, that would be the ideal, right? Like that, if that was possible, or if it is possible, this would probably be one of the best ways of building such a thing. What we found with Kiwi News is that it's just very difficult. Like,
of course,
my co-founder and I, we have spent like 1.5 years now building a community. And it's just really tough to, I think, grow without having just a big bank account full of money to, you know, leverage on all sorts of things. Like the community is great, like, don't get me wrong. And, you know, the community is very valuable because it's actually like everybody's serving everybody else and so on. But for us, the main point that is very tricky to solve is just the sustainability at the moment. Like, we are full time on it. We have to pay rent and the NFT is not cheap. Many people think it's actually very expensive to onboard to a social media site for 20. I think right now it's like $20. So it can be helpful to have outside investment or sponsors or some form of capital, because, for example, like, core challenges are that when you are bootstrapping your business, then you are much more risk averse and it's your own money. So you're also going to not spend it on like crazy bets that might never, you know, they have like a very low chance of
20 trade shows and like an office that you definitely don't
need. Instead, actually, what you are doing is the worse the outlook becomes on the market and the less money you have in your bank account, you're like, what do I have that I can already leverage to just make a little bit more money so that I can spend some time again that I can invest on longer term projects? Like, for example, I would love to build a better wallet experience. This has been the most tricky thing for us with Kiwi News, that Ethereum wallets are just really bad for onboarding to a social media website. Yeah. And Farcaster, for example, I always use Farcaster because I think we are very similar in terms of the, you know, the businesses that we run. But Farcaster had much more investment, also more time. But the Warpcast app, for example, is just awesome as a decentralized social media wallet, you know. But it's like not compatible with Kiwi News, so we can't use it. And I would just love to have also something that is, you know, more network independent, that you can use. And maybe, you know, that is something that you don't have to, you don't even have to, you know, store your money in it. You just store your social identity in it or whatever. But the problem with this is that, like, we don't have the capital to create that. So we have to kind of try to find solutions that still work with the very limited runway that we have. And so I think this is like a very hard trade-off that you have to make when you're bootstrapping, is that there are just fundamentally things you cannot do. Like, and you will kind of have to constrain yourself on the small projects that in the short term kind of create prosperity. And I think this also, you can also see that with how we've built stuff with Kiwi News. Like, in the very beginning, I still had a lot of money on my bank account. And so we built like the peer-to-peer network and so on. And we built like, and even then, you know, we got like retro PGF from Optimism like a year later. And we had like 3 or 4 months where we could really invest in the project without having to make and without having to increase our monthly revenue somehow. And during that time, all of the kind of bigger features, the more speculative features, were built. And now we're just like back to optimizing, right? Like, we there's this kind of the projection for the end of the year looks very humble. Like, I think we're going to survive, but you know, we're going to have to work hard to just get to that point. And so during that period, I mean, we are not taking very big bets. We're actually focusing on fundamental value. How well does the site load? Is it usable? Is the content good? All of these things. Like, are we selling? Can we sell more, you know, by giving people rebates and discounts and stuff like this?
Yeah, it's really like the life of a bootstrap founder. It's quite different from the super funded, super shiny startup out there.
It's very different. It's so different, I think, that it's often kind of very difficult to get empathy or sympathy from people, because, I mean, it's very often that people just say, yeah, just raise venture capital, right? Like, that's the... And then you can go into like 1 hour of discussion why you don't want to do that or whatever. But also, I think it's not only that. Like, the kind of catalog of advice these days, and this is really, this is like mind-blowing, actually. Like, it is so constrained towards raising venture capital. Like, basically, as a bootstrapper, you have to look at all of the advice from like VC or some startup school program or whatever. And you have to be like, are they just saying that because their companies have like $1 million in their bank account and they can purely focus on growth? Or is this like actually good advice, right? Mm-hmm. And so you have to approach this entire space all the time with this kind of extremely critical mindset, and you have to be like, is this like really useful or not? And just to, yeah, I don't know, there are like tons of examples of this, right? Like, the people come to our website and they're like, but you know, you are asking for 20, you know, to sign up to your website, I need to pay $20. Like, you should be focusing on growth. And so, like, growth, what does it mean? It means that it's obviously like, price is a huge friction, right? So the cheaper you can get it, the higher you can have growth, which I don't think it's wrong. But it ignores the very real problem that we have to, at the end of the day, also pay rent with the income that we get. And this is like the, you know, in August, we made like $800 from NFT sales. It contributes, like, as stupid as it sounds, like, this contributes to paying rent, right? So setting it to zero is kind of not really a good way of arguing, because the more business oriented way of arguing is like, how can we make it so that less people are disturbed by the 20 euros, right? So, like, for example, can we give them a slight discount that will make them feel more happy? Or our website copy, you know, are we saying the wrong things? Like, are we too aggressive, for example, in how we are selling this, and people don't want us to give $20 and so on? So, like, how can we leverage what we already have to improve the, you know, the result at the end of the month?
Yeah, the result on that on the end of the month, and also like taking that, which I believe, since I've been working with SaaS and startups and similar, what I believe a lot of startups should actually look into, especially bootstrapped startups, taking that third person bird's eye view and seeing what is already there. And for everything, asking the question, like, is there an easier way to do this? Is this really the way to get to that stage? To get to that goal at this stage of the process? Or is this more like another phase of the actual process? Really having, just as you said, like being very analytical and asking those questions, but asking those questions for every step of the way. And another thing, which I think that is very important that you mentioned it, is a lot of those super fun startups out there, and all they do is speak about growth, is, yes, but what about all these other things that now bootstrap startup founders usually take you for granted that they should do this, this, and this, mm-hmm. to get to that. But what about all these other things that you did not even mention that are actually super important until for you to get to that stage. Because otherwise, how are you going to get there?
You know, when you, again, I'm only talking hypotheticals, right, when I say this, but when you have $1 million in your bank account, you're not going to think about making more money from those $1 million at that moment. Also, I think the kind of pipeline is you're going to spend $1 million on growing, showing numbers, and then you're going to get more money and you're going to spend it again and so on. So, and when I was never a VC funded founder, but I have worked in startups. And the one thing that I notice is that when you don't have skin in the game as somebody contributing to a startup, meaning you kind of don't feel the pain and the upside of being in that startup, you end up bringing a lot of opinions about what you think is correct to work. And so I don't think I did necessarily a bad job when I was working at startups, but I always had, like, you know, my point of view of how things should be done. Like, I'm a developer, which means, you know, in these companies, I would often argue in favor of my colleague developers for code quality and stuff like this. You know, as you say, yeah, like maybe somebody in marketing or a founder will say, oh, it's like very important for me to be at all of the conferences all around the world because I'm like speaking to all of these people and so on. And this is kind of a phenomenon of having a lot of money to spend but not really being like hungry to actually pursue like real business opportunities. So what I've noticed with myself being, and you can look this up, like I have published, you know, beautiful code repositories with all of my ideals, you know, being expressed there and whatever. But when you are exposed to like the existential process of having to make money to pay rent and whatever and keeping your business alive, this makes you settle inevitably. Like, and this kind of like settling process for me, it is happening every other month or so, where I'm just basically forced through market pressures to reconsider one of the things I have held very dearly as an ideal to myself. And then I have had to come to terms with maybe giving that up or, you know, solving it in a different way, or even just like, yeah, just completely letting it go, basically. And I think this is, I don't want to even miss that, you know, because I've worked in places where we have been very well capitalized and I have surely also done a great job there. I just think that right now being faced with really, really making it work, it's a different quality and it really makes you kind of your best self. And this is something I actually really love about being in that position, despite all of the, you know, the economic troubles and everything that we're having. It just feels like such an amazing learning experience. Like, because if I can make this work, if I can actually generate money on the internet, I mean, this is so, like, this is such an awesome skill, right? Like, and the fact that, like, we're already making, like, the median over the last year has been, like, we've been making, like, $500 from NFTs very steadily. And it's not great, right? Like, considering the amount of money that we spent, like 1.5 years, two people, it's not great. Like, it would take decades for it to pay off or whatever. But it is pretty awesome that this works. And like, you know, it is also a question of whether I would have to be present for like, or if it can just self-sustain itself, this kind of money. So I'm also really like, I'm trying to learn this. I'm trying to understand, like, what is sales? What is marketing? How does it actually work? Like, how does making business, being in business actually work?
Tim, that was beautiful. Like, thank you for sharing directly from the heart.
Sure.
Before we end the episode, I just want to ask you, is there any last things that you'd like to say to the audience?
Yeah. I think... Going back to kind of this idea of only having access to this very VC funded startup kind of library of advice. For me, it would be very helpful as a bootstrapper if we as a community would be more connected with each other and we would share advice. Because I really feel like there are a lot of people in crypto everywhere on the internet that really think the only way of building a business is by getting investors. And it's just absurd. Like I really believe this doesn't have to be the way. And I also think, you know, you can build small and medium-sized businesses on the internet and you shouldn't feel bad about it or like feel ashamed when somebody's doing something more ambitious. Actually, you should just be really happy with, you know, being able to do something that you really stand behind and you believe in. So my call to action for the community is that if you feel the same way, or, you know, if you are in the same position, then let us somehow organize a bit better to also have a canon of, you know, advice for startups that really want to go that route. Because, you know, Web3 is here, like DeFi exists, we can take loans from our ETH collateral, like we can give ourselves credit, these kind of things. We can take money from other people, we can sell NFTs. I mean, unless the SEC says that OpenSea is selling securities or whatever, but like there are many tools now that could really make this very viable, just as like for businesses and to, you know, create new businesses. And so if we could as a space like come closer together and build a community around this and create a catalog of advice, then I think this by itself can become a vibrant ecosystem.
Yeah. It's definitely about having that collective effort and really building things that, first of all, excite us, and also, second of all, help the collective grow together. Because, like, we've personally, I think, like, we've been so much focused for decades, hundreds of years even, on that individualistic type of thing and individualistic focus, that right now, if we really want to grow as a society, even, we got to work as a collective.
Yeah, work together, not alone.
Thank you for tuning in with us on this episode of The Optimism Show. To get the key notes of this episode, go to insights.optimism.show. And don't forget to leave a comment on who would you like to see as our special guest on the next episode of the show. And until then, stay optimistic.